Okay, well, I see that the hour has officially started. Let me go ahead and mute out the line. Peter, can you still hear me?
Yep.
Fantastic. Okay, well, first of all, Peter, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're quite busy, and we really appreciate you taking the time out of your full schedule to join us for one of these interviews.
Great, it's a pleasure.
So, first of all, let me just start by introducing Peter Fraser to everybody.
Peter Fraser.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Peter Fraser. Hold on one second. There seems to be a lot of background noise. So anyway, Peter Fraser originally started as a bookseller and publisher in Toronto and in England before discovering homeopathy and training with Misha Norlin, Janet Snowden, David Mundy, and other teachers. He became particularly interested in groovings and has been involved in conducting or collating more than 20 individual groovings. His study of provings and new remedies led to the writing of The AIDS Miasm, which was published in 2002. And Peter's also written a series of books on materia medica, including birds, snakes, spiders, and insects, and another series on using maps and systems in homeopathy, which you can read. Realms, Mapamundi, Correspondences, Provings, and Philosophy. In the summer of 2011, Peter and Caroline Dent will be moving to British Columbia in order to run the Vancouver Homeopathy Academy and to continue its tradition of excellence in classical homeopathic education. And let me also mention that Peter will be starting the course in September for the Vancouver Homeopathy Academy. If anybody wants more information about that, they can visit their website, which is homeopathyvancouver.com/becoming. Also, Peter Fraser will be doing a seminar in Toronto on April 15th, 16th, and 17th. Peter, do you know if that's your phone that's making all that noise?
No, it's not mine.
Okay. So that'll be on April 15th, 16th, and 17th, and that'll be in Toronto. And also, he's going to be doing a conference for the West Coast Homeopathic Society, and that'll be on April 30th through May 1st. And just for people's knowledge, in addition to the books that Peter's already written, he'll be coming out with a new book called Using Archetypes in Homeopathy. This will be the seventh in a series on systems and philosophies, and also one on drug remedies, which is the fifth in his Materia Medica series. So again, thank you so much for joining us, Peter. I thought I would start by just reading a short passage that Peter sent to me as kind of a context for the questions that I might be asking. And Peter wrote, "We often describe the disease as a place of being stuck. However, we can only be stuck trying to move. It is not a concept that applies to the case of stability. The center of the case, therefore, involves two things. The dynamic place where change is happening and the way in which that change is being prevented or made more difficult. There are a number of groups of remedies that move from one realm to another, such as the birds, the insects, and drug remedies, all of which are involved in a movement from the realm of the earth into the realm of the sky." So these are very intriguing words you wrote, Peter. And I wanted to start by asking you, why specifically you're interested in remedies that involve transformation between the realms?
Well, those remedies that are actually involved in the transformation point out rather easily where the place of change is happening. We know it's in this realm of movement from the earth into the sky. And so it's much clearer where the change is happening, and it's much more obvious. So they're a good place to learn about this.
Interesting.
By studying them, we can learn much better how we recognize this place of change, this place of movement, in remedies that are not so obvious.
And Peter, why is the dynamic place of change in a remedy or a case so important?
Because that's where the center of the case is. We see cases that have a lot of stuff going on. And we tend to become, because we're holistic, we tend to become interested in so much more than just where the pathology, where the case is. And we can get easily distracted and start examining too wide an area of the patient, too wide an area of the case, when we should be looking for a much more specific area that matters. And this place is the dynamic place, the place where things are moving, and so are getting stuck.
Interesting. You know, Peter, today there's a lot of focus on remedies that are prescribed within a particular grouping, and I'm just curious what your perspective is on, you know, how to differentiate the members of a different grouping, because oftentimes their symptoms do overlap. You know, you look at, for example, snake remedies, and you see very often that they have a sensitivity to having the external throat being touched, or you see a lot of forsaken feelings, or you see a lot of hemorrhagic diaphysis. You know, you look at the spiders, and again, you see a lot of activity, a lot of nervous system issues. So can you talk a little bit about the need to differentiate between the members of a group, since there is quite a bit of overlap there?
Yeah, and we don't really know whether we need to differentiate. There are a lot of areas where perhaps any snake will do the trick. But it's more interesting, certainly, for us. And there is some evidence to suggest that the more accurate we can be with our prescription, the more effective that prescription is going to be. So it is worth being able to find exactly the right member of a group rather than just giving the well-known Polycrest member of that group. When I started writing the book on the AIDS miasm, my reason for doing that was there were a lot of these new provings coming out, and they had a lot of similarity in them. So people who knew a few of these remedies were prescribing those few because they did cover most of the symptoms, and they weren't differentiating in a much wider area. So in any group of remedies, the bulk of the symptoms are going to be the same. They're going to be very similar, and they're not helpful in differentiating. Once you've decided on a group of remedies, it's the symptoms that aren't part of that group that help you differentiate between the various members. So if you know the group symptoms very well, you can then more easily spot the symptoms, the outstanding characteristic symptoms that aren't from the group. And those are the ones that will help you find a remedy that's very precise, very accurate, and so very effective.
Peter, when you practice now, do you primarily focus on a group of remedies, or do you more focus on finding an individual remedy, or do you do a combination of both?
I try to find the group first if I can. Sometimes it's not that way. Sometimes the individual remedy pops up on its own and stands out for its own characteristic idea. But I'll often try and narrow it down more slowly and say, well, this is probably one of this group of remedies, because that does make the individual differentiation much easier. If you've got that specific, if you've got the general symptoms, you can find the particular symptoms more easily.
Right. And, you know, when you're talking about snakes or spiders, insects or birds, you know, obviously, you know, I've done quite a bit of research into the snakes and spiders, for instance, and, you know, because their venoms are so similar, you know, it would make a lot of sense that you'll see a lot of similarities in the symptomology between the members of the grouping. But when you're looking at some of the plants, for example, Solanacea or Asteraceae or Apiaceae, do you also find that there's a lot of correlation between the members of the grouping, or do you find that there's more of a divergence?
No, the animal kingdom seem to be on a higher level, and so the differentiation there, the groups are much more evolutionarily similar, and so the remedies are much more similar. But the plants, you get diversity in a family of plants. Some families contain trees and tiny little flowers at the same time. So there can be less similarity, but there are almost always some symptoms that seem to to be part of the group and not just part of the individuals. And those are useful because you can recognize them more easily. They are slightly more generalized, but they're therefore more likely to appear and more we can see them more easily. So it's good to know those. And often if you've got a remedy that's worked well but hasn't quite hit the spot, that's often a good reason to look at other remedies in the same family because they might be close enough. The one you've used might be close enough because it's part of the family, but not close enough because it's not the right individual remedy.
Right, right. Yeah, I actually think of it, I can think of a case of where the patient looked very much like a pulsatilla case, you know, which of course is the ranunculaceae family, and she very much looked like she needed pulsatilla, but actually she had taken pulsatilla, self-administered pulsatilla previously, and actually had arrested her menses. She became amenorrheic. So it wasn't a case where pulsatilla was a remedy you could really prescribe because she had not responded positively to taking pulsatilla in the past. And the way the case was solved actually was by looking at the ranunculaceae as a grouping. There was one member, Aquilegia vulgaris, which is from the Columbine, and even though that remedy didn't cover all of her symptoms, it covered a few of them, and enough of them that because it was not well represented in the literature, it became actually a very good choice as a prescription. It actually acted curatively in the case. So I can certainly see that sometimes, you know, this botanical or taxonomical way of looking at a grouping can be very, very useful and can assist you in finding remedies which are not particularly well represented in the literature. My question to you is, do you sometimes think that people could limit themselves? Like, in other words, they could think, oh, it's got to be a solanacea, it's got to be a primulaceae, it's got to be a scrofularacea, and then they simply exclude every other possibility and might miss a very obvious remedy. Do you think that's a possibility? Or
yeah, that's obviously a very common danger. The family likeness is an indication. It's never a certainty in any way. And it's just something to get you thinking that way. I mean,
right.
In homeopathy, we shouldn't be looking at facts as individual facts. We should be taking much more of an overview and seeing the pattern. And there will be some sort of pattern that runs through a family of remedies. And recognizing that pattern indicates it's well worth a look at other members of the family who might fit better than the best-known ones. But it's not necessarily so. The pattern is always changing and moving, so we have to be very free and easy with it and able to discard our decisions as quickly as we make them.
Peter, you know, one of the popular methods out there is the vital sensation method developed by Rajan Sankaran, and he also approaches the case starting most of the time, at least with the grouping, although I was actually at his seminar in Goa recently, and he actually presented a day from his practice, and many of the cases actually, at least it appeared to me, were prescribed simply based on the characteristic symptoms and were pretty typical remedies. But at least in most of his books and in mostly what they teach in the Bombay group, they do start with the grouping. And then from within the grouping, they identify various miasms for each of the individual members of that group. Is this something you do as well, or it's not something you're looking at?
What the sensation, the Bombay method, has introduced into homeopathy is a reversal of our normal way of looking at it. We normally look for the place in which the stuckness is happening, that dynamic place. We try and find that first, and then we try and differentiate by the quality of the stuckness, the way in which things are being prevented from moving on, the way the person is being prevented from fulfilling their higher purpose. So this is the way that we've normally done it. I mean, in the tradition in which I've been trained, we often use the Mappa Mundi to find the place, and then the Myers to find the quality. The sensation method that has turned this around in the looking for the quality first, and then using the the Sankaran miasms to find the place and to differentiate that way. I think it's a little harder to do that way in some ways. The place is easier to find than the sensation is. But by flipping it around, it's woken us up to a lot of different ways of looking at it. And it's woken us up to the need to be very precise in the way in which this quality of the stuckness, of the thing that thwarts the patient from fulfilling their higher purpose is presented. And so it's been very useful that way. I think in time we probably will go back to looking for the place first and the sensation, the quality second as the differentiating factor, because it is easier to do and it makes more sense in the way of looking at the case. But it's been very useful to make us much more precise in understanding the quality and not to take it in a very general way, but to find the exact quality of what's preventing the patient from moving on.
Interesting. You've been talking about the dynamic center quite a bit, Peter, and you mentioned just a moment ago using Mapamundi to help find that dynamic center. Are there many ways of locating the dynamic center in the case?
Yeah, there are a lot of ways of helping find it. There are a lot of forms of which are used in counseling and things that have been are being adapted into homeopathy, and all these things like focusing and hukumi are ways of finding what's really at the center of the patient's distress and disturbance. So they are helpful. It's useful to use the sensation method. It's useful to use understanding this the idea of transformation, where transformation is happening. They'll always be dynamic there. So it's a good way of becoming used to finding that place where movement is happening and where movement is stopped from happening properly. So we can use a lot of different techniques to help us find the dynamic center, and then we can explore it in more detail, find out what's going on at that place. And this is particularly useful because we don't have to look so carefully at the other areas that don't relate to this dynamic center. So much of a case is actually background information. It's useful in some ways, but it's often a distraction. So by finding the dynamic center first, we're able to use the pattern we find there to match the pattern in other parts of the case and realize which parts of the case are relevant at this time and which might be coincidental, might be accidental, or might be a different part of the patient's life and the patient's illness.
Peter, I want to go off on a different track for a moment. You know, in the Organon, in Aphorism 108, Hahnemann is very adamant that the best and maybe only reliable way of really understanding a remedy is to conduct a proving on it. And yet today in practice, a lot of people who are using botanical groupings and the vital sensation method and some of the other new approaches are prescribing many remedies which have never actually been proven. And they're actually, you know, making the argument that actually it's not necessary to conduct the proving to be able to use a remedy in practice. So I'm curious, what is your position? Do you feel that provings are important, and what part do they play in our understanding of and development of materia medica?
Well, provings are the only way to really understand a remedy. Yeah, it's just not possible to understand it fully from the doctrine of signatures and the family groupings and other things like that. The things that are most characteristic about a remedy are the things that are unusual, that are surprising in some way. So when you conduct a proving, it's these symptoms that suddenly jump out and they say, this is what I'm about, this is my character as a remedy. And it's something special that you would never have guessed at quite often. So I fail to see how you can understand a remedy without a proving. That's not to say that you can't use a remedy. Often you will have enough information. If you know that the remedy you want is from MMA, you can often take a direction from the remedies we know, and take ideas from the remedies we know, and that will lead you to a place where you might be lucky and you can give a remedy that is a great remedy. But to find the characteristic nature of a remedy, it only comes out in approving. It's there to surprise you. It's something about the remedy that is unusual, is different, is characteristic. And it's characteristic in a...
candy khati ja rahi
hai. Sorry. In a deeply unusual way. It's something special. You know, if you meet a person, the thing that helps you recognize that person is always something that's distinctive, unusual, that you wouldn't expect to see there. Then you remember that, and that's the thing that tells you that's this person. The same thing with a remedy. Remedies are like people we know and our friends that we know well, that we've had an experience of being with. We know the quirkiness about them, the strange, odd, peculiar things about them. And these are the things that help us identify them, but also that make them our friends, that make them interesting to us. Whereas people we know less well, the people that that are acquaintances or friends of friends, we know them, we know the general outline of who they are and things about them, but we don't know these quirky details, the things that make them special, the things that you smile at when you think of your close friends, the things that you recognize when you meet their children, you see something that's really special, really characteristic of the parents and the children, and you know that's what's really important. And it's the same thing with remedies. We should know them as our friends. We should recognize them as we walk down the street, which is what Kent said, that remedies should be our friends. And the thing that's important about our friends is not the things that everybody knows, but the things that you know by being with them, by spending time with them, which is what approving is. It's spending time with the remedy, learning the intimate details of what's special, what's individual about it. So that's why I think that not only are they important for understanding the remedy, but they're important for us to keep up that communication, that communion with the remedies.
Peter, you've done a number of provings now. I'm curious, first of all, when you do your provings, are you doing them in a Hahnemannian manner? Are you doing these, do you do them double blind? Do you do the mass placebo? What is the method that you took? And also maybe, have you learned anything interesting in the process of improving?
Sorry, I didn't quite hear the last sentence.
I was just curious, in addition, if you could tell us how you've done the proving, what you've learned through the proving process.
Well, I do a number of different kinds of provings. I think that through the history of our creation of the Materia Medica, we have used a lot of different kinds of provings, and that there's nothing to say that one proving shouldn't be used, or one type of proving is the only type of proving we should do. Historically, many of our remedies were brought into the Materia Medica by a homeopath on a Friday night was a bit bored, so he grabbed a remedy out of his cupboard and took it and took notes. It most certainly wasn't double-blind, it certainly wasn't placebo or anything like that, but some of these provings have produced the real picture that tells us what a remedy is about. So the picture we have of camphor that comes from this really deep, dark place that the prover went into was just one of these, such of these provings. So there's nothing wrong with doing any type of proving. A very casual proving can give us a lot of information. A Hahnemannian proving can often give us too much information. Many people find a good detailed Hanuman proving too difficult to read and throw up their hands in despair and put it aside.
This is yours, you guys.
Peter, can I ask you a favor? I'm trying to mute out the lines, and I'm not successful doing that.
Right.
Could you hit star 5 on your phone?
Right, star 5.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, you did that. You hit star 5. Okay,
yep.
I think hopefully we've muted all the other people now.
Right.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You were saying.
So there's lots of different ways of doing proving. One of the dangers for us is to try and make our provings medical standard double-blind placebo tests, because this isn't helpful to us. We know that the effect of approving spreads a little wider, a little beyond the place where just the people taking the remedy. And if you have a group of people and some take placebo, they get affected by the proving. So the placebo trial becomes not only ineffective, but destructive of the proving. People on placebo have some of the symptoms of the proving if they're participating in it. And these symptoms, which are definitely part of the proving, should by placebo protocols be ignored and removed from the proving. So I think it's very dangerous for us to move into that place of trying to copy medical drug trials. We should model our trials on the way we use them, the way we understand they work. I find placebo a very dangerous concept in proving. Double blind is useful, but it's certainly not necessary, and even single blinding is not necessary. Many useful provings have come from people who knew exactly what they were proving. There's no reason why we should not need to know. Hello?
And I've done a number of provings myself. We did a number in Japan, and I learned a tremendous amount about just the whole every aspect of homeopathic practice. Were there any interesting stories or anything? Any things you want to share about the number of remedies that you've conducted provings on?
Yeah, I don't believe you can be a homeopath if you haven't been involved in a proving, and we will certainly be making provings part of the course we teach here in Vancouver, just as they are at Misha's School of Homeopathy. It's just such a complete experience of understanding the power and the subtlety of the remedies. It's something happens that's so subtle it's almost not happening, but it's happening in such a powerful, deep way that you can't miss it. And unless you've experienced that deeply as a patient, you have no idea of it. But even when you're experiencing it as a patient, you're caught up in it. It's at a very, your mind and your whole body is involved in your process of healing and your process of disease. So it's very difficult for you to see exactly what's going on. The best cures in a complete cure, you forget that you had the illness. So you forget the understanding of what the curative process has been. You never forget a proving experience. So I think it's absolutely vital for all homeopaths to be involved in at least one proving at some stage in their training and career. And I think it's a wonderful experience. It allows you to explore parts of your own susceptibility, your own potential that you might not come to in normal life, that might never be revealed. So it's a way of understanding yourself much better than you can by any other process, I feel. And it's fun. You're allowed to take yourself on a walk into your own possibility, and it's a fairly irresponsible thing to do. You don't have to be responsible for what happens. This is the remedy's fault. You can let yourself just enjoy being a little bit different, letting go of a lot of what yourself has become, and just explore a bit of the potential that might not might not otherwise be there. So it's a wonderful experience. I can't recommend it highly enough for any homeopath who hasn't been involved. And those symptoms that come out sometimes, if it is a blinded proving, to see how that remedy manages to take the essence of the substance and turn it into something with living character is a wonderful thing to see. They can be difficult experiences. A lot of people can suffer some fairly significant pathology during the proving, but it's very rare for that to become grafted onto the person. It's almost always something that comes and goes. It's only when you fight things and don't allow them to just happen that it becomes difficult and the proving experience becomes something you get locked into. All the proving people that have been involved in provings in a large way say definitely that proving is a very powerful positive experience for all the provers, and that's been my experience. As long as the provers go into it with a sense of excitement and anticipation and not with a sense of fear. Some provers tend to get into a place of fear and then it can become difficult. But if it's just an opportunity, then it's a truly wonderful, enlightening experience.
Peter, as I said, we did a number of provings in Japan, and it was very interesting. And I agree with you. I think it's a very essential part of the development of any homeopath in terms of their real deep understanding of what we're actually doing in practice. Do you when you do these provings, do you do journaling? Do the people who are going to take the proving substance, do they journal beforehand, or is that something that you don't have of your provers?
They keep a do you mean before the proving starts?
Yeah, before the proving starts.
Yeah, we have a pre-proving diary that allows you to establish the baseline state.
Okay.
I mean, one thing about homeopathy is it's a completely a relative science. It's never about absolutes. It's always about change and similarity. So it's not about what the absolute of what happens. It's about the way in which the person changes. And this is something that is often forgotten in reading and publishing provings. So that if a person is in a state that is regarded by many people as not ideal, and it changes in the direction which some people would like to see it change, they often see that as curative, whereas in fact it's not necessarily curative. It might be that this is just a change, and that in another person who wasn't in the place where it was slightly difficult, that change would not have been a good thing, and they would be moving from a good place into a bad place. So a timid person who became in approving more forceful would often think, oh, that must be a curative symptom. It's a cure of timidity in taking the proving. But actually, it usually means that the person has become more dictatorial, and the real symptom is one of dictatorial.
Interesting. Peter, let's go on a different course now. There's a lot of discussion these days about whether, there's some practitioners out there who, prescribe with a handful of remedies, maybe 50 or 60 remedies, 100 remedies. Hahnemann just had a little over 100 remedies that he used in his own practice. And he actually, even in aphorisms 162 through 171, he even talks about the whole issue of what do you do in practice when you have a limited number of remedies. And so as a consequence of this issue, there have been a lot of people who have been looking at different methods, including conducting provings, but also different ways of prescribing without conducting groupings on remedies. So I'm curious, what is your opinion about this? Do you feel that we need more remedies in practice, or do you feel that 100 remedies is enough, or the 200 that we have now, or if you spread it out, we've got maybe a few thousand that have some level of description in the Materia Medica. What is your feeling about this? Do we need more remedies, or is there a sufficient number of remedies in practice? What is your opinion?
Well, when you look at what Hahnemann was saying, he wasn't saying it was ideal that we didn't have enough remedies. He said we don't have enough remedies, so we have to work with what we've got. He wasn't saying we don't need any more. He was just finding a way of dealing with the situation in which we don't have enough. I think that new diseases require new remedies. New situations require new remedies. It's the law of similars in action. I think as a practitioner, I would much rather find a much more accurate correspondence between the patient and the remedy and not go for something that, even if it was good enough, I would rather be that bit more accurate, that bit more careful in what I do. It's what makes being a homeopath exciting and fun. So even if it wasn't needed for our patients, I think it's a great advantage to us. And I do think in the end that a lot of patients need a specific remedy. Sometimes they can get by. I was just presenting a case at a conference, and it took 7 years. And the patient got better bit by bit, definitely over these 7 years, and was helped. But I'm sure he wasn't helped as much as he was when I found a remedy that truly fitted his situation and that was much closer to it. So I definitely, for me, being more precise, being more accurate in what we do is part of the challenge and part of the excitement and fun of being a homeopath. It would be perfectly possible to do a great deal of good working with the Polycrest and not using any other remedies. But it wouldn't excite me in the same way. And I don't think in the end it would be quite as good for the patient. I think that if you get that really accurate remedy, you take the patient to a higher level of health. And so it's well worth doing. I think we can get carried away in examining a small area, and we get too many remedies from one area, and that some places where there are a lot of remedies we don't know, we don't understand yet, are being ignored, but that will even out in time. It's not a big problem.
It's an interesting question because, you know, right now, for example, in the plant remedies, most of our plant remedies come from about 35, 38 different family botanical groupings. But there are over 440 identified botanical groupings. So our representation from nature is so small, and there's so many groupings for which we really have no remedies in the literature whatsoever. And then even within a particular grouping, like if you take the Orchidaceae, for example, which has, you know, 25,000-plus members, and we've just got a handful on all the Materia Medica, it's an interesting question because we can see that there really is, at least at this point in our understanding of homeopathy and its representation in the literature, we have a really scarce number of remedies actually represented. So I guess my question to you is, do you feel that it's possible to give a remedy that's close and still move the case forward, or do you feel that there's only one really perfect remedy that can actually cure any individual case?
Oh, no, I have no idea whether that perfect similimum concept really exists. Certainly, the wrong remedy is absolutely a wonderful thing. It can do a lot. It can give you more information about the patient and about their illness. It can help the patient to see themselves much better. There's an argument to be made that homeopathy works because the remedy is similar to the illness, not identical to it. And there are many different ways that you can be similar. There's only one possible way to be identical. So I think the concept of looking for the perfect remedy is a dangerous one. It's an ideal we can aspire to. But if people get upset and people feel a failure if they don't find it, that's definitely not a good thing. And it's certainly not necessary to help our patients. Perfection's something very dangerous in the world. There should always be some mistake in what we do to allow the devil out. If we don't, if we make it perfect, the devil is trapped in it. So when they make Persian carpets and things, there must always be some mistake in it. A perfect carpet is a very, very dangerous thing.
Peter, you've written some lovely books, some nice little books that are very readable and give a nice overview of some of the different groupings of remedies. Maybe you could tell us, I know you've written one on the birds, insects. Let's start with the birds. Can you tell us what you feel is special about the bird remedies?
The bird remedies are fantastic remedies. Birds are fantastic things. Ornithology is not the extremely popular activity that it is without a good reason. Birds are very close to us. They're the animals that reach the evolutionary summit of the branch that starts with the reptiles and the dinosaurs. So these are very advanced animals. They're some of the stories about the parrots that are able to communicate and talk with us, and the abilities of many of the, especially the corvids, the jays and the crow family. They're remarkable creatures. They're fascinating. They're wonderful to study. And they're wonderful to prove. The proving experience of proving a bird remedy is unparalleled. I was one of the first provings I was involved with was of the peregrine falcon, and it's something I still think of with great affection. So they are wonderful remedies. They are dangerous because they're so lovely. We would love to give our patients a bird. Our patients would love to be given a bird remedy. So there's a subconscious drive towards them, which I feel perhaps goes too far a lot of the time. That desire to please can make us want to give those remedies when they're not really indicated. And the opposite effect applies to the insects. Who wants to tell your patient that he's a cockroach? Very difficult thing to do. Very difficult thing for us to get our head around. So I think the birds are overprescribed. I think as healing tools used homeopathically, they're overproved. But as tools for undergoing the proving experience, they're unbeatable. So it's often just a wonderful experience for a prover to take a bird remedy and to go into that place of a very spiritual, a very uplifted place. And I think that maybe patients can use it almost in a proving way rather than in a curative way to experience that, to gain a wider understanding of the world, even though it's not quite attached to their pathology. So I think they're very useful in that way, but I do believe they're overprescribed. And on the other hand, they do have a very strong effect. I think they can be used often in an acute situation that we haven't fully discovered yet. One of the limitations of provings is that they don't help us understand the acute use of the remedy very well. Most of our therapeutic usage has come from folk traditional usage of the remedy rather than from proving information. So I think there's a case to be made for us to look deeper into into the way we conduct provings to find a way of finding out more information about acute and therapeutic usage. My experience with birds has been that they unblock this stuck place very effectively, and the patient moves on from that. They move into a different place very quickly, and then there's not the need for a bird remedy anymore. They move into a different place, need a different remedy. So I haven't really seen much evidence that a bird remedy is a deeply constitutional remedy that will help the patient again and again through their life, in the way that many plant remedies and mineral remedies do. But they're fantastic things to have. They're fantastic to prove. They help us come to a deeper understanding of what remedies can do and what spirituality is and things. So we need to keep an open mind on them, I think. I think we need to find out more how to use them. For instance, condor and some of the owl remedies as well are fantastic remedies in grief situations. I use condor as one of my three top grief remedies now, in that place where people are stuck in grief or stuck in that place just before dying or a family member dying. So I think there are many of these acute situations in which birds can just give you a lift, carry you over that place of stuckness and move you on. And we haven't really found them yet. So another challenge for us as for the homeopathic community to find those places.
I could really relate to what you were saying about us, how much we like birds. I was just in Singapore, and my wife and I went to the bird park there, and you're right. I mean, all these people were congregating and arriving by busloads and looking at all the amazingly beautiful, diverse number of birds that are on this planet. And as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, you would never have this huge, I mean, obviously there's small insect museums and stuff, but you never have this insect park, you know, where people would go and look at all the insects. It's just a completely different thing with birds. But yet you do like the insects quite a bit, and I know you've written a book about it. So can you tell us a little bit about your fascination with the insect remedies and why you particularly have an interest in them?
Well, I love the insect remedies. I think they're very important for us. I think we have to get over our distaste for insects and investigate them much more deeply. There are so many of them. There are more species of beetle than there are every other species of animal put together. So just an enormous range of possibility in the insects. And the insects are of the earth. The birds are very much of the sky. When a chick is hatched, it really only just has to mature in order to be able to take to the sky. They are creatures of the air that are sometimes forced to earth. They're forced to earth to feed, and they're forced to earth to breathe. To breed. But they are spiritual creatures of the sky. Whereas the insects are very much creatures of the earth. They're part of the earth. They have to work very hard. They have to toil and sweat in order to become something different that is able to fly. They have to metamorphosize themselves. And if we think about our situation, we are creatures of the earth. We can take to the sky both physically and metaphorically going into a spiritual place. But we are very much stuck on the earth. We have to toil. We have to work every day. We have to tread the earth. And so I think that's more likely that we would need these insect remedies than we do something much higher, much more spiritual in the form of the bird remedies. The insects are also so much about change and transformation, that this and getting stuck in that place of changing. So, and again, the acute nature of insects is very strong. The remedies that we had until recently from the insect kingdom were some of our most powerful acute remedies, such as Apis and Cantharis. And the provings aren't bringing out quite as much detail of this acute state as we would like. But I think a lot of these remedies, like the dragonfly and the ladybug and other insect remedies, are extremely important acute remedies. We need to investigate that more deeply and find a way of getting this information from provings, because I think they will be very helpful in dealing with acute situations.
Interesting. Peter, the drug remedies, this is a book that you're coming out with very soon. And first of all, I'm curious which remedies you're grouping together as drug remedies. And then do you feel that the drug remedies actually form a coherent group?
Yeah, this is an interesting place where our form of pattern thinking rather than the facts comes into play. There is a pattern among a number of remedies where they're things that we use to change the way we feel, the way we think. They come from diverse places. Some are man-made, some are plants, some are minerals, some come from animals. So there's no sort of way of just saying this is a drug remedy. But if you study them, even if you study the way they're used crudely in society, there is something that defines them, that makes them recognizable. So we know that alcohol's a drug. We know that tea, coffee, these things are drug remedies. We understand that, cigarettes, just as much as things like LSD or amphetamines or ecstasy are. So there is something about them, even though we can't define it, that makes a drug remedy identifiable. So looking at it again in this term of transformation, moving from one realm to the other, a way of seeing it is that the drug remedies, like the insects and the birds, move from the earth into the sky, but they do it by going through the underworld, by leaving the body in order for the spirit to soar. And this is a very dangerous thing to do. Most of the spiritual use of drugs in the past has been very carefully controlled. It's been something that the users learn in great detail over a long time, and they acquire tremendous skill and power in order to be able to leave your body and soar into a spiritual place and take learning from that spiritual place. And we often tend to use drugs in a very different way that endangers us in that place of leaving the body to die and dissociating it from the mind, which is why the drugs are so feared and so dangerous. But if they're used properly, they do take you into that spiritual place. So they are an important group of remedies, and we need to understand them as a group in order to use them properly. We can differentiate between them. You can't differentiate within a group until you can define what that group is. So that's something I'm working on these days.
Peter, what about remedies like mandragora or stramonium? Would you also classify them as drug remedies, or would you put them in a different grouping?
What I feel happens with the Solanaceae is that they strive to do this. They tend to go into the underworld, and they get stuck there. So they don't make the final part of the journey. So many of the symptoms you see in the Solanaceae and Stramonium and Hyoscyamus and Mandragora and things are these symptoms of being stuck in hell, of looking down into an endless abyss that you're falling into and can never get out of. So I think they're a particular form of, you could term it, failed drug remedies. I think, interestingly, the only one of the Solanaceae that really seems to make it is tobacco. And tobacco seems to do what other drugs do, and to do it very well, which is why it is so addictive and so popular. And it doesn't get stuck in that place. It looks into the abyss and then moves away from it and moves up into the sky. I would class it as a true drug remedy, whereas something like strymonium aspires to be a drug and can't quite make it.
Just a second.
Peter, what about the other similar groups?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I see the snakes as being having their tails in the underworld and their bodies on the earth, so they're able to connect into the deep things of the underworld, the subconscious, in a way that most other remedies can't do. So they're definitely in there. And there are remedies, I think the lack remedies in the mammals in general. I think there isn't a distinguish between the lacs and the mammals. I think they are very similar. They seem to be moving in the other direction from these remedies. They move from the sky, from the spirit world, into the earth. They're about grounding into physicality. So working in the opposite direction. But again, can appear very similar when you look at them in general. Another group is possibly the trees. The trees are interesting because they're rooted deep in the earth and aspire to move into the sky. And the further they try to move into the sky, the deeper they have to put down roots in the ground. So they get into a place of conflict over this and of great difficulty. And every move upward requires a move downward as well.
Well, Peter, I think we should open it up and let some other people ask some questions. I do want to mention again that Peter and his wife, Caroline Dent, will be moving to Vancouver and starting the courses in September at the Vancouver Homeopathic Academy. You can find out more information on their website, which is homeopathyvancouver.com/becoming. And also, Peter will also be doing a seminar in Toronto April 15th, 16th, and 17th. Peter, where can they get information about that?
From www.rhronline.ca.
Okay, good. And also, Peter will also be presenting for the West Coast Homeopathic Society Conference on April 30th and May 1st. And you can visit the West Coast Homeopathic Society Conference website. I guess if you just Google West Coast Homeopathic Society, you'll find that information. And again, Peter's written a number of lovely books, and will also be coming out with two additional books, Archetypes in Homeopathy and Drug Remedies. So we only have a time for just a few questions. Peter, can you just hit star 5 again to open up the lines?
Okay, yep.
Okay, can people hear me? Does anybody have a question for Peter Fraser?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah, hello.
What is your process for deciding what group to look at for a case?
It's a process of finding a pattern. There are many, many different forms of groups, and this is just one way of them. But if you can find a pattern that runs through several different things, they form a group. So it can be all sorts of types of things. I think Lou Klein is someone who's investigated this in a big way and defined a great number of different groups that that there are out there.
My question is, how do you decide in a case, when you're doing a case, do you decide what group to look at?
There are a number of symptoms that apply to the group as a whole. So in a bird remedy, there's a sense of flying, floating. There are symptoms around being stuck to the ground, being called back to the ground. There's a degree of spirituality to the case. There are a whole load of symptoms like this that are the materia medica of the group as a whole. And once you've found that, then you look for the peculiarities that don't apply to the group as a whole, and that will differentiate the remedy itself.
How about in 10-15 minutes?
Great. I think we have time for one more question. So does anybody have one more question for Peter? We have just about 30 seconds left here. So if you got a question, this is your opportunity. Okay, well, Peter, we are on the hour. So I want to thank you again, and hopefully you'll come back and join us for another one of these interviews. And it's welcome to North America. It's nice to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and if everyone could give Peter Fraser a big North American welcome and thank you, I think that'd be great.
Thank you very much.
So, thank you.
Thank you.